Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who we have the privilege of being not only colleagues with, but also good friends, is our first and only guest for this hour. His name is former Congressman, former Ambassador Pete Hoekstra. He served in the United States House of Representatives, representing people of Michigan for quite a number of years in the House of Representatives. He was an extraordinarily effective legislator there, served, among other things, as the chairman of the House Select Committee on Intelligence. Who better to give us an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world? He has also served more recently as the U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, in which capacity he was really out there in the front lines of some of the challenges that we face internationally. He has recently, I'm ecstatic to say, joined the Center for Security Policy as the chairman of its new advisory board. And I wanted to, first of all, thank him for that important contribution, ongoing contribution to our national security capabilities and policymaking, and to invite him to talk a little bit about it. Pete, it's good to have you with us. I want to hit that and a great many other subjects with you. Thank you for giving us an hour of your time. I'm so appreciative.
Frank, it's always good to be with you. Thank you. I'm excited about joining the Center for Security Policy, the work that I'm going to be doing there with, Fred Flights and others. And you're right. One of the first things that we've been able to do was to put together a very nice group of individuals, knowledgeable individuals, who are involved in what we call the advisory board for the center. So, we've got, we've got four or five congressmen, leading the way is a friend, I'm sure, of both of ours. Peter King. I served in the House of Representatives with Peter for a number of years. He served on the Intelligence Committee with me, but he also has a tremendous amount of background because he chaired the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives. So, we're thrilled to have Peter on board. He just left Congress
We gave him our Keeper of the Flame Award, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. And so, he's great. We have Gil Gutnick, a member who spent quite a bit of time building relationships with various countries in Europe during his tenure in Congress. We have Bob Schaefer. We have John Shattig. Bob Schaefer is from Colorado. John Shattig is from the state of Arizona. We have Sue Myrick, another good friend. We have Michelle Bachmann. Then we've got some other folks who have served in the executive branch and a couple of people who have served in the private sector. So you roll it all together and it's like, hey, this is really a nice cross section of people who have experienced, the last administration. Many of them, served in part of the administration or, were very supportive of the Trump America First agenda, the agenda that, turned around, 16 years of very questionable policy by leaders from both parties. So you've got the congressional branch, you've got the executive branch, you've got some private sector folks, and so what are they going to do? They're going to advise us on, priority. What should we be working on? What programs? What issues do they see out there that, number one, we can all see the current issues. You've got China, you've got Russia, the Middle East and those kinds of things. But, what issues should the center be prepping for that might be moving to the forefront in the next 3 to 5 years? I mean, one of the critiques, I spent some time yesterday with Jane Harmon, my colleague, who served as the ranking member on Intel while I was the chairman. And, you know, she has a new book out. I'm going to be very interested in reading it. She says she treats me very well. But, you know, one of the critiques that she had for, you know, what's been going on in American foreign policy for so long is we take our eye off the ball of what's going to be coming in the future. We are consumed by the present and not looking at the future.
Right. This is a hardy perennial, unfortunately. The immediate takes priority over the important. And we're looking really at I guess the military would call it a target-rich environment. But you're right, Pete. Looking over the horizon is the name of the game, because if we can deal with some of these challenges before they eventuate, metastasize, we're going to be far better off than if we have to confront them full force at their on their timing. Let me ask you a little bit about the Trump agenda. Of course, you were a representative of our government during the Trump years to an important foreign government in Europe, the Dutch government. It really was a very important break from the policies of the past 16 years. I think you're right, is more true than not, even though part of those 16 years were under the George W. Bush administration, a Republican administration, the other eight under Barack Obama, of course. How would you characterize the America First policy of Donald Trump, Pete, and what are its most important differences from what we saw in those previous 16 years and what we're witnessing today, for that matter, under the Biden-Harris administration?
Well, you know, I'm actually just finished an op-ed on this. And the word that I would use is, and the word that Donald Trump would use is his foreign policy was disruptive. It disrupted the swamp. It disrupted our relationships overseas. And I think having been part of that disrupting relationships overseas, with some of our allies, it was a healthy disruption, you know, and what we're finding right now.
Constructive disruption.
Constructive. Absolutely. You know, and number one, Joe Biden says, hey, we are back. We did not leave the foreign policy playing field. We just changed the boundaries and changed the rules under Donald Trump. We never left it. We just, you know, implemented a series of different priorities and a different way of attacking the problems out there. Take a look at it. Under George Bush and Barack Obama, we ended up with wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Yemen. We had the caliphate that stretched across Syria into Iraq. I think it was almost the size of Pennsylvania. More than 7,000 American service members lost their lives. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 7,000 to 8,000 contractors. We spent $5 trillion. And people will be very surprised when I say this, but yes, Donald Trump tried a different approach. He tried an approach called diplomacy.
Just a second. We have to take a short break. I want to pick up on that very point when we come back, because it's worth a proper drill down. And we're going to talk about that and some of the other very stark contrast between the Trump and Biden policies with former Congressman Ambassador Pete Hoekstra, great American and chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Advisory Board, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say, with former Congressman, former Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, former U.S. Ambassador to the Netherlands, Pete Hoekstra, great friend of this program, a great friend of the Center and the country, for that matter. And it's always a delight to catch him and a real privilege to do so at length today. Pete, you were just getting into how you would characterize the new rules, the different approach that Donald Trump took, and why it was the right approach, particularly as it contrasts with what we're embarked upon now under the Biden-Harris team.
Yeah, like I said just before we went into the break, you know, people will be surprised to hear an ambassador say this, but Donald Trump, the Trump administration, America First, said, you know, we're going to deal with the challenges around the world. We're going to start with diplomacy, and we're not going to, you know, implement our foreign policy at the end of a bayonet. You know, and the greatest success is, and I was skeptical of this, I have to tell you, you know, when he said, hey, I'm going to put Jared Kushner, my son-in-law, in charge of trying to get a breakthrough in what's going on between Israel and other countries in the Middle East. And, you know, it took a while, but compared to what happened, you know, the previous 16, the previous 24 years or whatever, he did it. You know, we got the Abraham Accords, where you got a number of Arab countries who normalized relationships with Israel. And so Donald Trump took an unconventional approach. He challenged the swamp. He challenged Jared Kushner, but they got there. And so, you know, that's a huge one. Now, he tried with North Korea. We didn't get to where we wanted to, but we didn't lose any ground, more ground than what we'd lost under the previous administrations. At least we gave it a chance. So, you know, Donald Trump engaged and used diplomacy. The second thing that he did is he told, you know, and I'm in Europe, I'm in the Netherlands. The Dutch use about 1.2% of their GDP to support national security projects, to support NATO. A number of years ago, 2014, they promised NATO that they would spend 2% of their GDP to support the security efforts of Europe through NATO. Well, the Dutch came up way short, as did many other countries. And Donald Trump basically, I might have taken a slightly different tact, and I did when I presented it to the Dutch. You know, the president said, you know, maybe we should pull out. And I rephrased it a little bit. I went to the Dutch, and when I did my town hall meetings with the Dutch people, I would say to them, I said, what do you guys know about NATO that we don't, that you're unwilling to pay for it, and you expect us to pay for it? And, you know, is there something that you see in NATO that doesn't make it very valuable to you that maybe we should be aware of, and then maybe we will reduce our investment? And, you know, the howls and the screams that would come from the policymakers in the Netherlands, you know.
Yeah, here the interesting thing is this is endlessly used as a prime example of Donald Trump failing to lead or alienating our allies or otherwise behaving in a boorish fashion that caused the United States to fall into disrepute with our allies. But what I hear you saying is the practical effect of what he did was he got the job done. He engendered a new degree of support for and investment in NATO from those recalcitrant allies, something that his predecessors couldn't accomplish with all their jawboning and backslapping and the rest, right?
Oh, that's right. I mean, a number of countries ended up increasing their spending. The Dutch were not one of them. They, you know, they have a coalition government, and they said, hey, in our coalition agreement, you know, after the previous election, we laid out all of our spending plans. Increasing spending for defense was not one of them. The Dutch just recently had another election, and they're now putting together another coalition government. But I can tell you, with Donald Trump out of the White House, I will be very, very surprised if they will decide to increase defense spending, because there will be no pressure on them to increase spending. But the second part of this, it's not only money, but when you take a look at troop strength, and my wife was always the most vocal on this when we were engaging with the Dutch, is she said, you know, you're not putting your men and women into uniform. And what that tells me is not only are you unwilling to pay for it, but you're expecting that if we get into a war where there will be casualties, you're expecting American young men and women to be on the front lines, because you're not going to be able to go. Now, they have contributed in Mali. They have contributed in Afghanistan. They've taken casualties. But, you know, they don't have the resources to really fully engage with us in a, you know, what might be called a real war.
And this is unfortunately sort of symptomatic of a number of these European allies. So it's a point that applies not just to a relatively small country, but even bigger ones that are in a position to man up, literally, as well as pay up.
Yeah. And Donald Trump, the Germans are the worst, okay? They also don't spend, but they have a tremendous number of American troops there that they get a lot of money from. They, what happened with the Germans, the president said, we're going to strategically relocate some of our forces, put them perhaps where they're more needed, but also send a signal that, you know what, if you're not going to pay up, we're not going to be bolstering your economy by basing thousands of American troops in your country. What's the first thing that Joe Biden does? He says, we're no longer going to pull any troops out of Germany, and we're actually going to put more troops into Germany. The Germans are laughing all the way to the bank with this. And then you take a look at the economy. Michigan, I come from Michigan. We're an automotive producing state. And the Europeans have an advantage when they ship cars to the U.S. Donald Trump said, you know what, folks, I want to have the same access to European markets that European companies have to the United States of America. Ever since World War II, we've provided preferential treatment to Europe coming into the United States with their products and services, because we wanted to help facilitate the rebuilding of Europe. And the only way Europe would be rebuilt is if they had access to American markets, because if they didn't have access to American markets, they would have no consumers, because there was not enough money in Europe to build a good economy. And you know what? Hallelujah. It worked. Europe's economy, I don't know now with Brexit, with Britain out of the EU, I think our economies are now roughly the same size, but Europe, including the UK, is their economy is bigger than the United States. And Donald Trump said, I want the workers of Michigan to have the same access to Europe as what the workers in Germany have to the United States. And again, the Europeans, you can't do this. There goes this Donald Trump again. And, but he was fighting for, American workers and American companies on all of these issues.
Pete, these are really important points. And I think your perspective, having engaged directly with these allies, and I believe established that whether they like these policies or not, they respected Donald Trump for standing up for what he believed in and making it stick. Did they not?
Oh, they did. And, they didn't necessarily like the way that he presented it. But here's what you got from the media. I did a lot of media in the Netherlands. They don't like conservatives. They didn't like Donald Trump. They didn't like me. And you know what they did? They never talked about the policy. They never said, we really can't afford to pay for NATO, and here's why. The media would always focus on, did you see what Donald Trump said last night in his tweet? Or did you see what he said in this speech? And it's kind of like, I don't care. That's not the point. My job here is to promote Donald Trump's foreign policy to your government and to your country. So now let's get back to talking about equity and trade. Let's talk about NATO. Let's talk about China, 5G, and all of these types of things. And they said, no, you can't. You got to talk about these tweets. And it's kind of like, no, I don't. I'll talk about what I want to talk.
Yeah. Well, this is why you were such an effective representative for our country.
Yeah. The other issue from a national security standpoint that Donald Trump clearly did differently was our southern border. He applied the rule of law, the laws passed by Congress and signed by presidents over the last 20 or 30 years. He applied the rule of law. Joe Biden now is, it's gone. It's chaos. But the thing now, you have to take a look at what's going on. And this is what I wrote about. George Bush calls Republicans protectionist, isolationist, and nativist. I'm sorry, fighting for equity in terms of trade is not protectionist. Using diplomacy instead of a gun is not isolationist. Enforcing our border and immigration laws is not nativist. And yeah, it gets awful. But what it is,
there's a perfect example of the contrast with even another Republican, nominally at least, George W. Bush. Pete, we have to take another break. We will want to visit with you further on the policies towards countries like China, that, as you say, whether it's 5G or whether it's their military buildup, or it's their genocide or their, well, transnational criminal operations that are very much front and center in our foreign policy today and must be. We want to describe the differences between Donald Trump and Joe Biden on those topics, and we'll do that right after this with Congressman Ambassador Pete Hoekstra.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are continuing a really important conversation with a seasoned practitioner of U.S. national security policy, both as a legislator, including in his role as the overseer of our intelligence community, as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and as a frontline ambassador of the United States in one of our most important European allies, the government of the Netherlands. His name is Pete Hoekstra. He is, I'm proud to say, a senior member of the leadership of the Center for Security Policy these days, the outfit that makes this program possible, and chairman of its new advisory board. I did want to say, Pete, among the people that deserve a shout out in joining that new board, you mentioned some are in the private sector. One is a dear friend of this this organization, Barbara Winston, and I know she will be a very active contributor to your deliberations.
We're glad to have that kind of mix in the organization. Yeah, we need that those kinds of perspectives to make sure that we give the center the kind of guidance and advice and input that it needs.
Well, so true. Let's talk about one of the places where we are really in the front of, I think, the battle for getting right a foreign policy challenge, arguably the biggest this country has ever faced, namely from the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party that misrules it. Pete, you talked a little bit about this earlier, particularly in terms of, you know, what you were trying to get the Europeans to think and do about that threat. Characterize it for us, if you will, as to how the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping has really metastasized in just the past 5 or 6 years, and what that means not just for, you know, us, but for the free world more generally.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and I was in Congress, and perhaps one of the best votes that I made was in 2000 when I voted against permanent normal trade relations for China. I believe China cheated at that time. And we had to be able to hold them accountable every year. And without that, I thought they would just increase their cheating and their disruption in the world economy, and they would grow their economy at the expense of everybody else. And there were others who, you know, obviously who voted for it. It became law. And, you know, they were hoping that this that this engagement with China would bring China, you know, under the rules of international law. Well, they were wrong. And it's really, like you said, metastasized in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, China's become very aggressive. Donald Trump, and, you know, I think you were right. This is not a Donald Trump policy. I hope that this becomes the policy of the Republican Party, the America First policy that, in this case, identifies China as a geostrategic threat to us militarily and economically. I hope Joe Biden goes there, but I think he's going to go, well, you know, they're a competitor, and you know what? America is so great, we can compete and we can beat China. Yeah, in a free market, in a fair market, we can, but not when their businesses are subsidized by the Chinese Communist Party. I saw it in Europe. You know, Nokia and Ericsson, they're for 5G. They would come into my office and they'd say, hey, Pete, you got to understand what's going on. We go into other countries in Europe. We go into Africa. China comes in and they underbid us by 50%. And we take a look at Huawei and ZTE products. And, you know, there's no way their products can be 50% cheaper than ours from a cost basis. You know, they're basically the same price. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, they've got international goals and objectives in mind. They want to get 5G into these countries. So that, number one, they will have an access to information and data that they otherwise wouldn't have by having their networks installed. And the second thing is they want to put the West out of this industry. You know, under the Trump administration, we went to every country in Europe and we outlined the threats. The immediate threat of using 5G from Huawei and ZTE from a national security standpoint. And then the long-term threat that said, you know, if we lose our companies in this space, we're not going to get it back. We will lose this market to China. And America said, we're not going to do that. And then we used persuasion, and then we also used the hammer and said, you know, by the way, any secret or critical communications between our government and your government will only go through secure networks.
And by definition, those are not ones that the Chinese supply. And Pete, this is a microcosm, of course, of the larger agenda of this Chinese Communist Party, dominating the world, dominating the economies of the world, and essentially providing the infrastructure, notably through this so-called Belt and Road Initiative, that will enable them to project power and control the flow of information and data and so on. So this is an epic threat. I think there's no question about it. Do you sense that our allies are now becoming more convinced that it is a threat and more aligned with us, or are they still on a path towards, well, appeasing, accommodating, and ultimately being, I'm afraid, you know, subordinated to the Chinese Communist Party and its country?
No, I think that we made significant progress all across Europe in countries, whether they liked it or not, they started recognizing the threat. But more importantly, they recognized that America was serious about confronting this threat. And knowing that we were serious, they started taking it seriously. My fear now is that if they see that the United States is less serious than what we were, they're going to become less serious. You know, the bottom line for much of the EU is they are driven by the god of profit and markets in the short term. And so there's nothing that they'd like more to do. Many of their companies would love to reopen up, you know, with Huawei and ZTE and these types of things for perhaps a short-term gain and a long-term strategic loss. And, you know, we talk about 5G, but I think the one that is on the horizon, and this again is something that we are talking about with the advisory group, is rare earth metals. Okay, China wants to control rare earth metals, which are so important to various technologies, the battery technology and all of that, the green energy technology. And if China gains control of rare earth metals, the rest of the world is going to have a huge price to pay. So I'm going to be very, very interested, number one, in what the Biden administration, what their first take is on how they're going to deal with rare earth metals and how they're going to deal with China on this issue. And then if they're at the wrong place, I'm sure that the center and I'm sure that Frank Gaffney will be great partners and doing everything we can to move the Biden administration to where we need to be and to present to the American public the chaos and the vulnerability that the Biden administration is going to be putting America into.
Yeah, you can count on it. We'll certainly be doing it here. Yeah, we are very, very keen to be working with you in this regard. Pete, let me turn to one other foreign policy challenge, which I know you've spent an enormous amount of time on over the years, namely Iran. There's clearly under this administration a very different attitude towards the Iranian regime. Just characterize that for us, if you would, quickly, and where you think it's likely to leave us.
Well, you know, this is going to be appeasement not only to Iran, but also to our European allies. They're going to, in one shape or form or another, they're going to get back into the Iran nuclear deal. There have been reports this week that they were going to do a prisoner swap where we were going to give Iran a bunch of money. I hope those were false reports. But, you know, the Biden administration is committed to getting back into the Iran deal. And maybe the only reason is because Donald Trump got us out. But, you know, they've already laid their cards on the table. They got back into the climate deal, which is awful for American workers and American businesses. You know, without any changes at all, I think they'll get some surface changes to the Iran deal. But, you know, it's going to create more instability. It will undermine the Abraham Accords. You know, we were developing a great way to, you know, control and box Iran in the Middle East, and getting back into the Iran deal is going to give them an opening and a way to get out.
Pete, we had a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, Carolyn Glick, on the show yesterday, and she thought that where this is heading between the Biden administration's desire to appease the Iranians and the effective emboldening that translates into, on the one hand, and the dissing of Israel and our allies in the Gulf is likely to conduce to war very quickly. Do you think that's a distinct possibility at the moment?
Well, it's always a possibility. It's a frightening possibility because of, you know, what that means. You know, it's not going to be 1991 all over. It's not going to be you know, going into Iraq in 2003, it's going to be very, very, I think it'd be very, very different. And it's a frightening prospect. It's a possibility, you know, but it's frightening to me.
Possibility that it might happen, yes, and possibility that it might not be confined to that region. Pete, we have to take one last break. We're going to come right back and we're going to talk about domestic policies under the Biden administration and some of the really alarming qualities they represent. We'll be right back with Congressman and Ambassador Pete Hoekstra right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this important and very timely conversation with one of our great American leaders, former Congressman Pete Hoekstra, until recently the U.S. representative to the government of the Netherlands as our ambassador there, now the chairman of the advisory board of the Center for Security Policy. Congressman Hoekstra, Mr. Ambassador, let me ask you about a very different kind of problem. Namely, here on the home front, in what I call the war for the free world, we have a new report out of CNN. Tucker Carlson talked about it last night with Senator Josh Hawley. It's really quite chilling. It talks about the Biden administration considering, quote, outsourcing to private entities the surveillance of Americans' communications in ways that would otherwise be impermissible for the government of the United States to do, at least without a warrant. And you and I have talked in the past, Pete, about the seeming determination of this administration not only to politicize, but actually to weaponize agencies of the government, the intelligence community, Homeland Security, FBI, military personnel even. This goes a whole nother step. Talk a little bit about what's happening at the moment and what may now be in the offing should this kind of thing go forward.
Let's first start off by what we know. We know that the Director of National Intelligence, and this is through Chris Stewart, the Republican congressman who's on the Intelligence Committee, the Director of National Intelligence has broadened the guidelines in terms of what the intelligence community can do in the United States of America. You know, there used to be a real clear wall saying, hey, foreign intelligence is exactly what it says. Foreign intelligence. Our spying community cannot be used against Americans. And there are some gaps or some cracks appearing in that wall. This also came up at the National Threats Global Threats Briefing a few weeks ago, the public hearings, where, you know, I believe it was the director of the CIA, it was not Bill Burns, it might have been the DNI, refused to say that the intelligence community could not operate in the United States of America. So, you know, the intention is clear. This administration is creating some opportunities for the intelligence community to operate against perceived threats. And we know what that, they've already said, you know, that can go as far as including libertarians. That's scary. And it's wrong.
Certainly includes Trump voters, doesn't it?
Yeah. Many of us believe that, you know, what they're really saying is, hey, we're going to be targeting conservatives, Trump voters, and those types of things. And so the natural extension of that would be for them to start taking a look at how they can get around the law using domestic law enforcement capabilities to get information that otherwise they legally would not be able to get. And, you know, I find it very difficult. I'm not a lawyer, okay? I'm a marketing guy. I'm a business guy. So I'm not a lawyer, but I find it... And one thing I know is lawyers, especially government lawyers, can be very, very creative. And maybe they have found a way that they will pay, you know, private sector companies in the United States to gather information that they are legally prohibited from gathering or collecting. But, you know, that may be possible, or they will ask these companies to gather this information. And then at certain times, you know, they can go and they can, then get a warrant from the court to get this information, because companies have been collecting information that otherwise they maybe would not be collecting. So,
or maybe, Pete, they simply ask them to share it. And here, this is the kicker, as it seems to me, these so-called woke capitalists have become increasingly aggressive, as I mentioned, with respect to curbing free speech, even that of the president of the United States, for heaven's sakes, Donald Trump, when he was in office. And, you know, coming forward with the kind of enforcement mechanism of, you know, you must get vaccinated, even though the government won't formally tell you that, through these so-called passports. These are the sorts of things that you may not actually need a warrant to extract from willing partners in the leftist, capitalist boards of directors and so on. That's really troubling on so many different levels. And let me give you another example of this, Pete, because I think you're absolutely right to suggest that we're watching them transgress bounds that have long been established, I thought, by law, for that matter. Rudy Giuliani and Victoria Tenzig, two of Donald Trump's lawyers, have now had their electronic equipment essentially seized, including an incredible amount of information about, you know, attorney-client privilege that would be compromised as a result. It seems as though that's another example of this administration, the Biden-Harris administration, ignoring at a minimum the norms, if not the actual constitutional bounds that have long been, you know, part and parcel of how we govern ourselves. to the extent that that is happening, what can we do about it, as you see? What can Republicans in Congress, like you used to work with, for example, do to try to stem this?
Well, the difficult thing right now is it's hard for Republicans to do the oversight necessary that you would expect the Homeland Security Committee or the Intelligence Committees to do the oversight, because, you know, they're run by the Democrats. But, you know, that's why I love talking to you, Frank. I hadn't thought about companies willingly sharing this information, which, you know, is absolutely outrageous, collecting and sharing it when otherwise it would be a violation of these government agencies to get this information. But, you know, speaking from experience on foreign intelligence and foreign surveillance and getting information on external threats to the United States, there are multiple examples. Obviously, I can't go into them, but where private, American corporations would very willingly work with our intelligence community to help us get the information that we needed to keep America safe. And that was always a point of pride.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. We had to make compelling cases for that to occur, but it did. But that was, again, there was no question. These were targeted at enemies of the United States, enemies of the state. And, you know, when companies now use this extreme power to potentially monitor Americans, it gets really, really scary, because the same companies doing this are the companies that are worried about, well, hey, what's the Biden administration going to do on taxes? What's the Biden administration going to do on antitrust and these types of things? And it's kind of like, hey, we will, with a wink and a nod, we can do these kinds of things. But, it'd be nice if we talked about some of these other issues at the same time. And that gets us to a very, very dangerous place to be in. Then the bottom line is the U.S. government should not be that creative in how to spy on America. Use your creativity to get us better roads, to make our schools work and those kinds of things. But don't spend your time trying to come up with creative ways to spy on your political opponents in the United States of America.
Yeah. Amen, Pete. And I think this is the kind of message that I'm sorry you're not delivering in Congress any longer, but we appreciate so much that you are now free to do it with us at the Center for Security Policy on this program. Hope you come back to our Securing America TV program as well very soon, because your voice is desperately needed at a moment when I'm afraid a lot of your colleagues are not stepping up as we need them to in defense of our freedoms in the face of what seems to be an increasing fascistic tendency on the part of this administration and some of its friends in the corporate world. Pete Hoekstra, we have to leave it at that. Thank you. The time has flown by. We appreciate it so much, and we look forward to a visit with you again in the near future. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.